Chapter 7. He had begun with small, tentative chips into the marble, but as he had grown more confident in his vision, and the bitterness towards Bekwa Kinska had risen once more, he found himself hacking at the marble, with no more thought to his actions than a wild beast. Ostian drew a stale breath through his mask and took a step back from the marble block, leaning against the metal scaffolding that surrounded it. The thought of Bekwa made him grip the metal of his chisel tighter, and he felt his jaw clench at the depth of her spite. The sculpture was not going as smoothly as he would have liked, the lines more jagged and harsh than would normally be the case, but he couldn't help himself. The bitterness was too great. He thought back to the day he and Serena had walked arm in arm to the embarkation deck, their thoughts joyous and carefree at the idea of discovering a new world together. The corridors of the Pride of the Emperor were abuzz with excited speculation in the wake of the Emperor's children's victory on Laren, or as it was formally and correctly known, 28-3. Serena had come to fetch him the moment the word had gone out, dressed in a fabulous gown that Ostian had felt sure was unfit for a journey to a world where the surface was composed entirely of water. They had laughed and joked as they made their way through the fabulous high galleries of the ship, joining more remembrances the closer they got to the embarkation deck. The mood had been light, artists and sculptors mingling with writers, poets and composers in a happy throng, as armoured Astartes escorted them towards their transports. "We're so lucky, Ostian," murmured Serena as they made their way towards a huge gilded set of blast doors. "How so?" he asked, too caught up in the festive atmosphere of the crowd to notice the baleful stare of Bekwa Kinska at his back. He was finally going to see the ocean, and his heart leapt at the thought of such a wondrous thing. He calmed himself by remembering the writings of the Sumatran philosopher Salonum, who had said that the real voyage of discovery consisted not in finding new landscapes, but in having new eyes with which to see them. "The Lord Fulgrim appreciates the value of what we're doing, dear heart," explained Serena. "I've heard that in some expeditions the Remembrancers are lucky to even see an Astartes warrior, let alone get a trip to the surface of a compliant world." "Well, it's not as though Laren's exactly hostile anymore," said Ostian. "There's nothing left of the lair. They're all dead." "And good riddance, too. I've heard it said that the War Master won't let any of his remembrances down to the surface of 6319 yet." "I'm not surprised," said Ostian. "They say that there's still resistance, so I can see why the War Master's not letting anyone down." "Resistance," scoffed Serena. "The Astartes will soon have that quashed. What's the worst that could happen? Haven't you seen them? Like gods unto us they are, invincible and immortal." "I don't know," said Ostian. "I've been hearing some rumours in La Fenice of some quite appalling casualty figures." "La Fenice," tutted Serena. "You should know better than to believe anything you hear in that nest of vipers, Ostian." That at least was true, reflected Ostian. La Fenice was the area of the ship the Emperor's children had given over to the Remembrancers, a great theatre in the high decks that served as a recreation space, eating hall, exhibition area, and place of relaxation. During the course of the fighting, Ostian had taken to spending his evenings there, chatting, drinking, and exchanging notes with fellow artists. The currency of ideas was in full flow, and the thrill of being in an environment where designs were tossed into the air and swatted around with lively debate, each time acquiring some strange new form its originator had not yet conceived, was intoxicating. Yes, La Fenice fostered ideas, but when the wine flowed, it was also a hotbed of scandal and intrigue. Ostian knew it was impossible to put so many people of an artistic persuasion in one place without generating operas worth of salacious gossip, some of it undoubtedly true, but some wildly inaccurate, slanderous, and downright lunatic. But the stories that had come back regarding the ferocity of the fighting on Laren had the ring of truth to them. 300 dead Astartes was what some people were saying, but others put the figure even higher, at 700, with perhaps 6 times that injured. Such figures were nigh impossible to believe, but Ostian could only wonder at the force of will that would be required to destroy an entire civilization in a month. It was certainly true that the Astartes he had seen around the ship were more sombre of late, but could the casualties really have been that high? All thoughts of dead Astartes had been washed away as he and Serena entered the embarkation deck through the mighty blast doors that sealed it from the rest of the ship. Ostian's jaw fell open at the sheer scale and noise of the space, its ceiling lost to darkness, and the servitors and craft at its far end rendered minuscule by distance. The cold blackness of space was visible through a flashing rectangle of red lights that indicated the edge of the integrity field, and Ostian shivered, terrified of what might happen should the field fail. Menacing storm birds and thunderhawks sat on launch rails that ran the length of the massive deck, their purple and gold hulls pristine and gleaming as they were tended to like the finest studs of the stable. Wheeled gurneys snaked through the deck, carrying crates of shells and racks of missiles. Fuel tankers rumbled, and brightly coloured crewmen directed the chaos with a measure of calm control that Ostian found amazing. Everywhere he looked, he could see activity, the bustle of a fleet that had recently been at war, the deafening industry of death rendered mechanical and prosaic by repetition. "Close your mouth, Ostian," said Serena, smiling at his amazement. "Sorry," he muttered, finding new marvels at every turn. "Huge lifters carrying armoured vehicles in mechanised claws as though they weighed nothing at all, and phalanxes of Astartes warriors marching in perfect step both on and off gunships." Their escorts kept them in line, and Ostian soon recognised the intricate ballet of movement that operated in the embarkation deck, realising that, without it, this place would be a nightmare of collisions and anarchy. Where before there had been an irreverent atmosphere among the remembrancers, all levity ceased as they were herded through the embarkation deck towards a towering, handsome Astartes warrior and a pair of robed iterators standing on a podium draped with purple cloth. He recognised the space marine as First Captain Julius Caseron, the warrior who had attended Bekwakinska's recital, but he had never seen the iterators before. "Why are there iterators here?" hissed Ostian. "Surely there's no populace left to sway." "They're not for the lair," said Serena. "They're for us."
"For us?"
"Indeed. Though the Lord Fulgrim appreciates us, I assume he still wants to make sure we see the right things and say the right things when we get back. I'm sure you remember Captain Julius and the man on the left with the thinning hair. That's Ippolita Zygmunta, a decent enough sort. He loves the sound of his own voice a bit too much, in my opinion, though I suppose that's an occupational hazard for an iterator."
"And the woman?" asked Ostian, his interest piqued by the raven-haired woman's stunning countenance.
"That," said Serena, "is Coraline Aseneca. She's a harpy, that one, an actress, an iterator, and a beautiful woman. Three reasons not to trust her."
"What do you mean? Iterators are here to spread the word of the imperial truth."
"Indeed they are, my dear, but there are some that only employ words for the purposes of disguising their thoughts."
"Well, she looks pleasant enough."
"My dear boy, you of all people should know that looks are not everything. One with the countenance of Hephaestus may have the most beautiful soul, while she, with the comeliness of Cytherea, can harbour the bitterest heart."
"True," agreed Ostian, glancing over at the blue-haired form of Bekwakinska and remembering her attempted seduction of him.
He turned back to Serena and said, "If that's the case, Serena, how can I trust you, since you are also a beautiful woman?"
"Ah, you can trust me, because I am an artist, and therefore seek truth in all things," Ostian.
"An actress seeks to conceal her real face from her audience, to project only what she wants you to see."
Ostian chuckled and returned his gaze to the platform as Captain Julius Caseron began to speak, his voice deeply musical and worthy of an iterator.
Honoured remembrances. It gladdens my heart to see you here today, for your presence is a vindication of what my fellow warriors and I have achieved on Laren. The fighting was hard, I won't deny it, and it tested us to the limits of our endurance, but such endeavours only help us in our quest for perfection. As Lord Commander Eidolon teaches us, we always need a rival to test us, and against whom we can measure our prowess. You have been selected as the preeminent documentarists and chroniclers of our expedition, to travel to the surface of this new world of the Imperium and tell others what you have seen.
Ostian felt his chest swell with unaccustomed pride at the praise the Astartes had placed upon them, surprised at the eloquence with which the warrior had delivered his speech.
Laren is still a war zone, however, and as units from Lord Commander Fios Palatine secure the planet, it behoves me to tell you that you will see evidence of our war and the raw, bloody aftermath of killing. Be not afraid of this, for to speak the truth of war, you must see it all, the glory and the brutality. You must experience all the sensations of history for it to matter. Any who feel their sensibilities would be offended by such sights should make themselves known, and will be excused.
Not a single soul moved, nor had Ostian expected any to. To see the surface of a new world was too tempting for anyone to resist, and he saw that same knowledge on Caseron's face.
"Then we shall begin with the allocation of transports," said Caseron,
and the two iterators descended from the platform and moved among the assembled remembrancers with data slates, checking names against those on their lists and directing them to the designated transport that would take them to the planet's surface. Coralina Seneca moved towards him, and his pulse quickened as he appreciated the full impact of her beauty. Sculpted, elegant, and with hair so dark it was like an oil slick. Her full mouth was painted a luscious purple, and her eyes sparkled with an inner light that spoke of expensive augmetics.
"And what are your names?"
she asked. Ostian found himself lost for words at the silky, liquid sound of her voice. Her words flowed over him like smoke, hot and making him blink as he struggled to remember what his name was.
"His name is Ostian Delafor," said Serena haughtily, "and mine is Serena Dangelus."
Coraline checked her list and nodded.
"Ah, yes, Mistress Dangelus, you are to travel on Perfection's flight, the Thunderhawk, just over there."
She turned to move on, but Serena caught the sleeve of her robe and asked,
"And my friend?"
"Delafor, yes," said Coraline. "I'm afraid your invitation to the surface was revoked."
"Revoked?" asked Ostian. "What are you talking about? Why?" Coraline shook her head.
"I do not know. All I know is that you do not have permission to visit 28-3.
Her words were seductively delivered, but cut like hot knives into his heart.
"I don't understand. Who revoked my invitation?"
Coraline checked her list with an exasperated sigh.
"It says here that Captain Caseron revoked it under the advisement of Mistress Kinska. That's all I can tell you. Now, if you'll excuse me."
The beautiful iterator went on her way, and Ostium was left stunned and speechless by the magnitude of Bekwa Kinska's malice. He looked up from the deck in time to see her ascend the boarding ramp of a stormbird and blow him a mocking kiss from her palm.
"That bitch!" he snapped, clenching his fists. "I can't believe this!"
Serena placed her hand on his arm and said,
"This is ridiculous, my dear, but if you cannot go, then I shan't either. Seeing Laren will mean nothing if you are not there beside me."
Ostian shook his head.
"No, you go. I won't have that blue-haired freak spoil this for both of us." "But I wanted to show you the ocean."
"There will be other oceans," said Ostian,
struggling to keep his bitter disappointment in check.
"Now go, please."
Serena nodded slowly and reached up to touch his cheek. On impulse, Ostian took her hand and leaned forward to kiss her, his lips brushing her powdered cheek. She smiled and said, "I'll tell you all about it in nauseating detail when I get back. I promise." Ostian had watched her board the Thunderhawk before being escorted back to his studio by a pair of grim-faced army soldiers. There, he began to attack the marble in his anger. The tiled walls and ceiling of the medical bay were bare and gleaming, their surfaces kept spotlessly clean by the menials and thralls of apothecary Fabius. Staring at them day and night, Solomon felt that he was losing his mind just lying here while his bones healed, unable to look at anything but their utter whiteness. He couldn't remember exactly how long it had been since his storm bird had gone into the ocean during the final attack of the Lair Atoll, but it felt like a lifetime. He remembered only pain and darkness, where, to keep himself alive, he had shut down the majority of his bodily functions until the rescue craft had pulled his shattered body from the wreckage. By the time he had regained consciousness in the pride of the Emperor's Apothecarian, Laren had long since been won, but the cost of that victory had been damnably high. Apothecaries and medical thralls bustled up and down the deck, attending to their charges with due diligence and fighting to ensure that as many as possible returned to full service as quickly as possible. Apothecary Fabius had personally tended to him, and he was grateful for the attention, knowing that he was amongst the Legion's best and most gifted chirurgeons. Row upon row of cot beds were filled with nearly 50 wounded Astartes warriors, and Solomon had never thought to see so many of his battle brothers laid low. No one would tell him how many of his brother Astartes filled the other medical decks. The sight made him melancholy. He wanted to get out of this place as soon as possible, but his strength had not yet returned, and his entire body ached abominably. "Apothecary Fabius tells me that you'll be back in the training cages before you know it," said Julius, guessing his thoughts. "It's just a few bones, after all." Julius Caesaron had been sitting next to him on a steel stool since Solomon had woken this morning, his armour gleaming and polished, the scars of war repaired by the Legion's artificers. Fresh honours were secured to his shoulder guards by gobbets of red wax, his deeds of valour recorded on long strips of creamy vellum. "Just a few bones, he says," replied Solomon. "The crash broke all my ribs, both my legs and arms, and fractured my skull. The apothecaries say it's a miracle that I'm able to walk at all, and my armour was down to his last few minutes of air when the search and rescue birds finally found me." "You were never in any real danger," said Julius, as Solomon painfully propped himself up in the bed. "What was it you said? That the gods of battle wouldn't let you die on a piss-poor excuse for a planet like Laren? Well, they didn't, did they?"
"No," groused Solomon. "I suppose not. But they didn't let me fight in the final battle either. I missed all the fun, while you got all the glory by the Phoenician side."
He saw a shadow pass over Julius's face and said,
"What is it?"
Julius shrugged.
"I'm not sure. I'm just not sure you'd have wanted to be at the Primarch's side at the end. It was unnatural in that temple."
"Unnatural? What does that mean?"
Julius looked around as though checking for any who might be listening and said,
"It's hard to describe, Sol, but it felt as though the temple itself was alive, or something in it was alive.
It sounds stupid, I know."
"The temple was alive? You're right, that does sound stupid. How can a temple be alive? It's just a building."
"I have no idea," admitted Julius, "but that's what it felt like. I don't know how else to describe it. It was horrible, but at the same time it was magnificent. The colours, the noise, and the smells. Even though I hated it at the time, I keep thinking back to it with longing. Every one of my senses was stimulated, and I felt energised by the experience."
"Sounds like I should try it," said Solomon. "I could do with being energised."
"I even went back with the remembrances," laughed Julius, though Solomon could hear the confusion in it. "They thought it was such a great honour that I accompanied them, but it was not for them, it was for me. I had to see it again, and I don't know why."
"What does Marius make of all this?"
"He never saw it," said Julius. "The third never made it inside the temple. By the time they fought their way through, the battle was already over. He went straight back to the pride of the emperor." Solomon closed his eyes, knowing the anguish Marius must have felt upon reaching the field of battle and discovering that victory was already won. He had already heard that the third had failed to reach the battlefield in accordance with the Primarch's meticulous plan, and knew that his friend must be suffering unbearable torments at the thought that he had failed in his duty.
"How is Marius?" he asked at last. "Have you spoken to him?"
"Not much, no," said Julius. "He's been keeping himself confined to the armament decks, working his company day and night so they will not fail again. He and his warriors were shamed, but Fulgrim forgave them."
"Forgave him?" asked Solomon, suddenly angry. "From what I hear, the southern spur was the most heavily defended part of the atoll, and too many of his assault force were shot down on the way in for him to have had any hope of reaching Fulgrim in time."
Julius nodded.
"You know that, and I know that. But try telling Marius. As far as he is concerned, the third failed in their duty, and must fight twice as hard to regain their honour."
"He must know that there was no way he could have reached the Primarch in time."
"Maybe, but you know Marius," pointed out Julius. "He thinks they should have found a way to overcome impossible odds."
"Speak to him, Julius," said Solomon. "I mean it. You know how he can get."
"I'll speak to him later on," said Julius, rising from the stool. "He and I are part of the delegation that is to meet Ferus Manus when he comes aboard the Pride of the Emperor."
"Ferus Manus!"
exclaimed Solomon, sitting bolt upright and wincing in pain as his wounds pulled tight.
"He's coming here?"
Julius pressed a hand on his shoulder and said, "We are due to rendezvous with the 52nd Expedition within 6 hours, and the Primarch of the Iron Hands is coming aboard. Fulgrim and Vespasian want some of the most senior captains to be part of the delegation." Solomon pushed himself upright once more and swung his legs from the bed. His vision swam and he held tight to the bed frame as the gleaming walls suddenly grew sickeningly bright.
"I should be there," he said groggily.
"You are in no state to be anywhere except here, my friend," said Julius. "Caifan will represent the second. He was lucky. He made it out of the crash with nothing but a few scrapes and bruises."
"Caifan?" said Solomon, sinking back down into the bed.
He was an Astartes, invincible and immortal, and this helplessness was utterly alien to him.
"Keep an eye on him. He's a good lad, but a bit wild sometimes."
Julius laughed and said, "Get some sleep, Solomon, you understand? Or did that crash scramble your brains too?"
"Sleep," said Solomon, slumping back onto the bed. "I'll sleep when I'm dead."
The upper embarkation deck had been chosen as the location where the delegation from the Iron Hands would be met, and Julius felt a great excitement seize him at the thought of once again laying eyes upon Ferus Manus. Not since the bloody fields of Tigris had the Emperor's children fought alongside the 10th Legion, and Julius remembered the cries of triumph and the victory pyres with great pride. He wore an ivory cloak, its edges picked out with scarlet leaves and eagles, and a laurel wreath of gold upon his brow. He carried his helmet under the crook of his arm, as did his brothers who gathered with him to greet Ferus Manus. Marius stood to his left, his austere features drawn in a sombre expression that stood out amongst the excited faces that awaited this reunion of the Emperor's sons. Solomon was right, he decided. He would need to keep an eye on his brother and attempt to lift him from the pit of self-loathing he had dug for himself. In contrast, Gaius Caifan could barely contain his excitement. He shifted his weight from foot to foot, unable to believe his luck at having come through the crash that had so grievously wounded his captain, and then being selected to join this august assembly. Another four captains made up the rest of the gathering: Giandor, Tyrion, Antaeus, and Hellespont. Julius knew Shandor reasonably well, but knew the others only by reputation. Lord Commander Vespasian talked quietly to the Primarch, who stood resplendent in his full battle plate, the golden-winged gorget sweeping up over his shoulder to the level of his high Shishak helmet, the lamellar Aventail sweeping down across the shoulders of his armour in a glittering cascade. The golden sword, Fireblade, was belted at the Primarch's waist, and Julius was unaccountably glad to see it at Fulgrim's hip instead of the silver handle blade he had taken from the Lair Temple. Behind them, the vicious beaked prow of the Firebird watched over proceedings, the Primarch's assault vessel sporting a fresh coat of paint after her fiery entry into the atmosphere of Lairon. Vespasian nodded at whatever Fulgrim said and turned to march back towards the company captains, his face set in an expression of quiet amusement. Vespasian was everything Julius could ever desire to be as a warrior, controlled, graceful, and utterly deadly. His golden hair was short and tightly curled, and his features were the very image of everything an Astartes ought to be, regal, angelic, and stern. Julius had fought alongside Vespasian on countless battlefields, and the warriors he commanded would boast that his prowess was the equal of the Primarch's. Though all knew that such a boast was made in jest, it served to push his warriors to greater heights of valour and strength to emulate the Lord Commander. Vespasian was also immensely likeable, for his incredible abilities as a warrior and commander were tempered by a rare humility that made others warm to him immediately. In the manner of the Emperor's children, warriors who followed Vespasian would take their lead from him in all things, his example serving as a model of how they might best achieve perfection through purity of purpose. Vespasian moved down the line of captains, ensuring that everything was in order, and that his captains would do the Legion honour. He stopped before Gaius Cafan and smiled.
"I bet you can't believe your luck, Gaius," said Vespasian.
"No, sir," replied Cafan.
"You won't let me down, will you?"
"No, sir," repeated Cafan, and Vespasian slapped a gauntlet on his shoulder guard.
"Good man. I've got my eye on you, Gaius. I expect you to achieve great things in the coming campaign."
Cafan beamed with pride as the Lord Commander moved to stand between Julius and Marius. He nodded curtly to the captain of the third and leaned over to whisper to Julius as the red lights of the integrity field began to flash.
"Are you ready for this?" asked the Lord Commander.
"I am," replied Julius.
Vespasian nodded and said,
"Good man. At least one of us is."
"Are you trying to tell me you are not?" asked Julius with a smile.
"No," grinned Vespasian, "but it's not every day we get to stand in the presence of two such beings. I have a hard enough time being around Lord Fulgrim without looking like a slack-jawed mortal, but put two of them in a room."
Julius nodded in understanding. The sheer magnetism of the Primarchs was something that took a great deal of getting used to. The force of their personalities and sheer physical charisma, leaving men who had fought the darkest horrors of the galaxy trembling with paralyzing fear. Julius well remembered his first meeting with Fulgrim, an embarrassing encounter where he found he couldn't even remember his own name when it was asked of him. Fulgrim's presence humbled a man with its flawlessness and exposed his every imperfection. But as Fulgrim had said to him after that first meeting, "This is the very perfection of man, to find out his own imperfections and eliminate them." "You have met the Primarch of the Iron Hands?" asked Julius.
"I have, yes," said Vespasian. "He reminds me of the War Master in many ways."
"How so?"
"You have not met the War Master, have you?"
"No," said Julius, "though I saw him when the Legion marched at Ulanor."
"Then you will understand when you do, lad," said Vespasian. "Both of them come from worlds that hammer the soul with fire. Their hearts are forged of flint and steel, and the blood of Medusa surges in the Gorgon's veins, molten, unpredictable, and violent."
"Why do you call Ferus Manus the Gorgon?"
Vespasian chuckled as the immense form of a heavily modified stormbird eased through the integrity field, its midnight black hull glimmering with wisps of condensation. The engines growled as the craft turned, its increased bulk formed by racks of missiles and extra stowage compartments fitted at its rear.
"Some say it's a reference to an ancient legend of the Olympian hegemony," said Vespasian. "The Gorgon was a beast of such incredible ugliness that its very gaze could turn a man to stone."
Julius was outraged at the disrespect in such a term and said, "And people are allowed to insult the Primarch in this way?"
"Don't fret, lad," said Vespasian. "I believe Ferus Manus quite enjoys the name, but in any case, that's not where the name comes from."
"So where does it come from?"
"It's an old nickname our Primarch gave him many years ago," said Vespasian. "Unlike Fulgrim, Ferus Manus has little time for art, music, or any of the cultural pastimes our Primarch enjoys. It's said that after the two of them met at Mount Narodnia, they returned to the Imperial Palace where Sanguinius had arrived bearing gifts for the Emperor. Exquisite statues from the glowing rock of Baal, priceless gemstones and wondrous artifacts of aragonite, opal and tourmaline. The Lord of the Blood Angels had brought enough to fill a dozen wings of the palace with the greatest wonders imaginable."
Julius willed Vespasian to reach the conclusion of his tale as the Iron Hand Stormbird finally touched down on the deck with a heavy clang of landing skids.
"Of course, Fulgrim was enthralled, finding that another of his brothers shared his love of such incredible beauty. But Ferus Manus was unimpressed, and said that such things were a waste of their time, when there was a galaxy to win back. I'm told that Fulgrim laughed and declared him a terrible Gorgon, saying that if they did not value beauty, then they would never appreciate the stars they were to win back for their father."
Julius smiled at Vespasian's tale, wondering how much of it was true and how much was apocryphal. It certainly suited what he had heard of the Primarch of the Iron Hands. All thoughts of Gorgons and tails were dispelled when the frontal assault ramp of the Stormbird lowered and the Primarch of the Iron Hands emerged, followed by a craggy-featured warrior and a quartet of Terminators, their armour the colour of unpainted iron. His first impression of Ferus Manus was of sheer bulk. The Primarch of the Iron Hands was a brutally rugged giant, his width and height quite unimaginable next to Fulgrim's slender frame. His armour shone like the darkest onyx, the gauntlet upon his shoulder fashioned from beaten iron, and a cloak of glittering mail billowed behind him as he marched. A monstrous hammer was slung across his back, and Julius knew that this was the dreaded Forge-Breaker, the weapon Fulgrim had forged for his brother. Ferus Manus wore no helmet, and his battered face was like a slab of granite, scarred from the ravages of 2 centuries of war among the stars. As he caught sight of his brother Primarch, his stern face broke apart in a warm grin of welcome, the sudden change almost unbelievable in the completeness of its reversal. Julius risked a glance at Fulgrim, seeing that grin mirrored in his own Primarch's face, and before he knew it, he too was smiling like a simpleton. To see such honest brotherhood between these 2 incredible godlike warriors made his heart sing. The Primarch of the Iron Hands extended his arms, and Julius found his gaze drawn to the shimmering hands that shone like rippling chrome under the harsh lights of the embarkation deck. Fulgrim went to meet his brother, and the 2 warriors embraced like long-lost friends, suddenly and unexpectedly reunited. Both laughed in pleasure at the meeting, and Ferus Manus slapped his hands hard on Fulgrim's back.
"It's good to see you, my brother," roared Ferus Manus. "Throne, I've missed you!"
"And you are a sight for sore eyes, Gorgon," returned Fulgrim.
Ferus Manus stepped back from Fulgrim, still holding him by the shoulders, and looked over at those who had come to greet him. He released his grip on Fulgrim's shoulders, and together they marched over towards the captains of the Emperor's children. Julius caught his breath at the nearness of Ferus Manus, the Primarch towering above him like a giant of legend.
"You wear the colours of the first captain," said Ferus Manus. "What is your name?"
Julius was horribly reminded of the first time he had met Fulgrim face to face, fearing a repetition of that humiliating experience. But as he caught Fulgrim's amused expression, he forced some steel into his voice.
"I am Julius Caseron, captain of the first, my lord."
"Well met, captain," said Ferus Manus, taking his hand and pumping it enthusiastically whilst waving forward the craggy-faced warrior who had accompanied him from the Stormbird with his free hand. "I have heard great things of you."
"Thank you," managed Julius, before remembering to add, "my lord."
Ferus Manus laughed and said,
"This is Gabriel Santar, captain of my veterans and the man who has the misfortune to serve as my equerry. I think you and he should get to know one another. If you don't know a man, how can you trust your life to him? Eh?"
"Well, quite," said Julius, unused to such informality from his superiors.
"He's my very best, Julius, and I expect you will learn a lot from him."
Julius bristled at the implied insult and said, "As I am sure he will, from me."
"Of that I have no doubt," said Ferus Manus, and Julius felt suddenly foolish as he saw the glint of mischief in his strange silver eyes.
His gaze slid from the Primarch to Santar, seeing an unspoken respect there as they sized one another up in the manner of warriors who wonder which of them is the greater.
"Good to see you still alive, Vespasian," said Ferus Manus, as he moved on from Julius to take the Lord Commander in a crushing bear hug. "And the Firebird. It has been too long since I saw the Phoenix fly."
"You shall see her fly ere long, my brother," promised Fulgrim.